It's great to be with you again this morning. So thankful for another Sunday and the privilege and the honor of being able to do what it is that we're doing here today. Take your Bibles, if you would, and turn to Esther chapter 4 as we continue our study through this book together. In a series we've entitled Trusting the Unseen Plan of God. The poet once wrote, "I am only one, but I still am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do." As you read the Bible, the overarching theme of the Bible is not what God can do through hundreds or thousands of people, but rather what God can do through just one willing person. It's everywhere you look in the Bible. It's page after page. It's example after example. The Bible is filled with story after story of what God can do through one man, one woman, one boy, one girl who is willing to stand up and say, "God, here I am, use me." Ezekiel 22:30 echoed the words so long ago that we still so desperately need to hear in our world today. God said, "I looked for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land so that I would not have to destroy it, but I found no one." God is still looking for a man, still looking for a woman who will simply say, "God, use me." The book of Esther bears witness so beautifully that God can use just one surrendered person. And I don't want us to miss that as we make our way through this book. Last week, just for a very quick recap, I know the announcements took 10 minutes today and they normally take 3. That means I get an extra 7 minutes. Is that right? Is that how that works? I'm not sure if that's how that works, but I'm banking on that today. So, God bless you, Ed. You did a great job with that, man. We had more announcements than we've ever had today, man. I felt bad for you. So a quick recap. Esther chapter 3 is where we were last week. Haman, the evil guy, very bad guy, Haman found out that the reason Mordecai refused to bow down and worship him, and remember, we saw the word worship there in the text. It's the same word used throughout the Old Testament for worshiping God. It wasn't just, hey, the king's orders are that you pay respect to Haman. It was the word worship. You have to bow down and worship Haman. Haman found out the reason Mordecai refused to worship Haman was because Mordecai was a Jew. And so Haman flies into a rage. He conspires with King Ahasuerus. They put together this plan to annihilate, to wipe out all the Jews off the face of the earth in all 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. All the Jews are going to be exterminated off the face of the earth. And they put the orders in place. They send out all the paperwork. The orders have been issued. They cannot be repealed according to the law. All of this has now been issued. The date has been set. The clock is ticking. The Jews are going to be exterminated. And chapter 3 concluded with Haman and the king sitting down to have a drink together while the entire city and all of the provinces are in complete turmoil over this news. So now we turn the page and we begin in chapter 4, verse 1. It says this: "When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth and ashes was allowed to enter it. Now remember, we saw last week Mordecai had been serving at the king's gate, and we said that that was the sort of, we would say, the administrative offices of the king. Mordecai had had a position there of some influence. He worked there day after day. But now he's torn his clothes. It's such a strange image for us. We have to force ourselves to try to get into that culture to understand what's taking place. He has torn his clothes. He's put on sackcloth and ashes. It is a sign of the deepest grief. And he's now sitting outside of these administrative offices, and he's crying and weeping and wailing loudly. This is a big change for him. Because before this, all the way up until chapter 3 of last week, he had only been a Jew behind the scenes. But in chapter 3, we saw he told them he was a Jew. And now he's identifying himself publicly as a Jew. He's identifying now with all the Jews publicly, because verse 3 goes on to say, in every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and wailing. Many people lay in sackcloth and ashes, and Mordecai is now right there, out in public with them. He's calling upon God publicly now, and he's willing to do this even right up to the king's gate, where he's been working every day, no matter who sees him. This is a big change now for Mordecai. And people do see him. And they take word now to Esther, his adopted daughter, who is now the queen, about the condition that he's in. And this begins a lengthy back and forth dialogue, this sort of text messaging it would be in our day, for the rest of chapter 4, this back and forth exchange of messages between Mordecai and Esther. Look at verse 4. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. She hears about Mordecai, and it disturbs her tremendously. She says, man, I can't have my adopted father looking like this in public. And so she gathers her people around her and says, here, take this Armani suit and these crocodile shoes and the best of the best. Take this stuff and give it to him. You know, some people go shopping when they're feeling blue, I guess. I don't, but I hear some people do, and they buy a new outfit and they get their hair done and whatever, and it makes them feel better, I guess. So she says, take all this nice stuff, give it to Mordecai, and surely this will make him feel better. They take all this stuff, they try to give it to Mordecai, but he refuses to put it on because no superficial outward change is going to remedy and soothe this deep grief that is in his heart. Esther hears about this. She hears that Mordecai refuses this gift, these clothes that she has sent, and now she knows there must be something very serious going on. This is more than just a minor issue with Mordecai, and it's at this point we realize, we kind of put the pieces together, we realize Esther is completely oblivious to the orders that King Ahasuerus and Haman have sent out about exterminating the Jews. And we have to understand, in these days, the queen did not live in the same part of the palace as the king, and we'll see that in just a moment. Clearly, she has not even been made aware yet. And this is very early on after these orders have been issued. She has not even been made aware of this news. So she doesn't understand even yet why Mordecai is mourning and weeping. She thinks maybe, I don't know, maybe he got a bad haircut or something, and he's just upset about something minor. And so she has been somewhere in some part of the palace where she's oblivious to what's even going on in the city at this point. So she's trying to soothe Mordecai for something superficial. And she hears, hey, look, he refused to accept the clothes and even put them on. So verses 5 and 6 tell us that Esther sends Hatach, one of her men, back to find out what's troubling Mordecai. Verse 7. Mordecai tells Hatach, hey, I want to tell you everything that has happened. He tells him everything, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Verse 8, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Mordecai says, listen, Esther, the king is going to kill me, and he's going to kill all the Jews, and you need to go into the king, and you need to intercede for your people. And once Esther hears this news and this messenger shows her the papers and the orders that her husband, the king, has signed, and that Haman is in on this, and she suddenly reads all of this and has all of this explained to her, and she understands the gravity of the situation and what has just been set in motion against the Jews, she realizes the seriousness of this situation. Cannot imagine the shock that set in. Look at her response in verse 10. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. A nice place, nice people, these folks, aren't they? The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. She says, Mordecai, listen, let's not get crazy. You know as well as everybody else, nobody can just walk into the king uninvited. Not even me. If I go in there, I could be put to death. A mild example of this. I mean, we're talking miles removed, but a mild example of this for us today would be that we can't just walk into the Oval Office and see the president. Some people have tried. They've tried to climb over the fence. They've tried to fly onto the grounds with one of those little microplanes, I think they call it. The moment they do that, they're tackled to the ground with machine guns pointing at their head, and they don't have a very pleasant day the rest of the day after that. Because you can't just force your way into the White House and go and see the president anytime you want to. And that's what Mordecai is asking Esther to do, except in those days, anybody who did that would be put to death immediately, even the queen. Josephus tells us in his historical writings that there were men standing on either side of the inner court with gigantic axes. Imagine getting up and having that as your job every day. You stood there all day holding a gigantic axe so that anyone who tried to force their way into the king's presence, if he didn't raise his golden scepter to accept you, you were dragged off and that was your job. Ba-boom. Mordecai is asking Esther to lay her life on the line for her people, and she says, no way. I'm not going to do it. And the statement she adds at the end of verse 11 lets Mordecai know that the odds of the king raising his scepter and welcoming her are very slim at this point. Because she said, the king hasn't even asked to see me in 30 days. I mean, how well is their marriage going at this point? Now, several years have passed since she became queen. This is a very condensed, compressed version of the events we're getting here in Esther, as is very common in the books of the Bible. She says, the king hasn't even asked to see me in 30 days. I haven't even seen him. I'm not even sure if he wants to see me at all, so I'd definitely be risking my life to go in right now. She says, I'm not going to do it. And at this point, she's really at a crossroads. If she doesn't go see the king, the Jews will die. If she does go see the king, she will likely die. And here's the other problem. If she does go see the king and say to him, King, the reason I'm here is because I'm pleading on behalf of my people, she'll have to admit now that she's a Jew. And by doing that, she'll be admitting that she's been deceiving or holding back this information about her nationality from the king this whole time. And the king doesn't like to be lied to, so it's very likely that she'll be put to death for that. So she's clearly thinking about her own safety, as, by the way, we would all be too. And her reasoning is, if I go to the king, I'll die, probably, so I'm not going to go to the king. If I reveal my nationality, I'll probably die, so I'm not going to reveal my nationality. So let's just leave things as they are. But Mordecai refuses to let her off the hook. Look at verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. Hey, can I just ask you, do you have anybody in your life who loves you that much to be that honest with you in those moments? I hope you do. He says, listen, Esther, don't think you'll be able to hide inside the king's palace. Yes, you and I, we've kept our nationality a secret for a long time, but I want you to know I've made it public now that I'm a Jew. And you're my adopted daughter, so it's just a matter of time before somebody connects the dots that you're a Jew as well. You can't hide behind your crown forever. Before all this is over, Esther, you'll be found out and you'll be put to death right along with all of us. And essentially what Mordecai is saying to Esther is this: choose who you're going to be. Choose who you're going to be. Are you going to be a Jew or are you going to be a Persian? Now is the time to decide. You might remember back in chapter 2, we saw that Esther had two names. Hadassah, her Jewish name, and Esther, her Persian name. She was named that after the Babylonian goddess. Anybody know? Yeah, Ishtar, the goddess of love and war. She had not been living by her Jewish name, Hadassah. She had been living by her Persian name, Esther. She had been living as a Persian. And now she's at a crossroads. And she has to decide whether she's going to identify with God's people or continue identifying with the pagans. She'd been living privately as one of God's people, but she had not been living publicly as one of God's people. In our day and age, we'd maybe call that being a Sunday Christian. You go to church on Sunday and you sing the songs, you do all that stuff, but nobody in your Monday to Saturday world knows really that you're a Christian. Jesus said, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words, I'll be ashamed of him at my coming. At some point, we all have to decide who we're living for. And if we don't make that decision willingly, sooner or later, circumstances are going to come along to force us to make that decision. And Mordecai and these events forced Esther to make that decision. You see, it's possible to live in two worlds for a long time, but at some point, our hand is going to be forced. We're going to have to make a decision. The light is going to be shined upon us. We're going to be called out. It's going to happen. And in this country, if things continue the way they are, Sunday Christians are going to be called out. There's going to be a day of reckoning, and we're going to be forced to choose. Are we in or are we out? Joshua forced the people to make a decision. Joshua 24:15, he called the people out. He said, if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, ooh, there's an awkward moment. Read everything leading up to that. If serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose you this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There's a line in the sand. He's not forcing anybody. You choose what you want. It's interesting. Same with Jesus. It's one of the remarkable things about Jesus. Jesus never strong-armed anybody into following him. Not one, unless I've missed it. He told them the truth. He gave them the invitation, and then he let people walk away. It's remarkable. If I was Jesus, I would have zapped people. I would have, No, not him. The beauty of grace. Walk away if you choose. Wow. But Mordecai's argument gets even stronger. Verse 14. He said, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from another place. Mordecai is not saying, Esther, if you don't do this, it's not going to get done. If you don't do this, you're really stifling God's plans. He's saying very clearly, Esther, if you choose not to go to the king on behalf of your people, God is still going to get this done. He's just going to use somebody else besides you to do it. And you're going to miss out on your opportunity to be a part of what God is doing. The question is not whether God is going to accomplish his purposes. The question is whether or not you want to be a part of it. I could preach for an hour on that, and I won't. I need to move on because we had so many announcements today. I've got to hurry. I'm just kidding you, man. I love you. Did you hear that, though? That's important. God, in his grace, invites us to be a part of what he is doing. And if we choose not to, he's going to get it done anyway, with or without us. Wouldn't you rather be a part of it? And then Mordecai presses the argument home with this final point at the end of verse 14. And here's the one we really, really misread. And I did for years. I misread this for years. He said, and who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. This, of course, is the most famous verse in all of Esther. Sandy and I had dinner last night with one of her old college roommates, and we caught up with them, and we were talking with them, and they asked us about our church, and Sandy said, yeah, we're teaching through Esther, and as soon as she said Esther, her roommate said, for such a time as this. And that's what people always say when you say Esther. It's right here, 4:14. That's what everybody always refers to. But I misread this verse most of my life until several years ago. Mordecai doesn't say he knows for sure that that's why Esther became queen. He says, who knows that this is why you've come to this place? Who knows? You and I don't know these things as we step out into the unknown will of God. Somebody tell me how your life is going to be a year from today. Go ahead, I'll wait. Tell me quickly that decision, that important decision you made this week, tell me quickly how that's going to turn out. I'll wait. We don't know. We follow God walking forward into the unknown by faith. And only afterward can we look back and see what God was up to. 2 Corinthians 5:7 says we walk by faith, not by sight. Do you think Gideon knew for sure that he was going to survive when he went into battle with a handful of men against an army that could not even be counted? Do you think Joseph knew for sure that things were going to turn around for him as he was being thrown into the dungeon for doing what was right? Not a chance. Do you think Peter knew for sure that he wasn't going to be put to death when he was thrown into prison in Acts 12, right after James had just been put to death with the sword? Not a chance. Mordecai isn't saying, Esther, I promise you, if you do this, your life will be spared and you will become a hero. He isn't saying that. He says, Esther, put your life on the line. Step out and do this. Who knows? Who knows? It's remarkable. It's a remarkable change in understanding this verse. Oh, I've heard this preached for years. This is your moment of destiny. Step into it. Hogwash. It's just not there. It preaches great. It's just not there. See, problem is, we read the story of Esther backwards. We know how it turns out. They didn't. This girl was terrified. He wants Esther to at least consider the possibility that it was no accident that she was chosen out of all those girls to be made queen. And that it was much more than her good looks that won her that beauty pageant. That behind all those events, it was God who brought her to that very place for a purpose far more important than just wearing a crown. So what does all this have to do with us? I mean, you and I will likely never wear a crown and have a royal position. But like Esther, our lives are just as much a part of God's unfolding providence. And I don't want you to miss that either. Which is why in the beginning of this series, in the first couple weeks, I wanted you to understand there's nothing special about Esther. She is not a hero. She's made of the same carbon and dust that you and I are. Wherever God has placed us, it's there that He wants to use us. You may sit in a cubicle full of papers every day, or a moldy warehouse, or a bank, or a retail store, or a medical facility, or a classroom, or a sales office, or a house full of noisy, snotty-nosed children. And you say, is this my divine destiny? God has brought you there for a reason. Don't ever underestimate what God wants to do through you there. One of the great tragedies of life is that we spend most of our lives wishing we were somewhere else. And we miss divine opportunities to bloom where we're planted. Someone once wisely said, and you English teachers, forgive my grammar for the moment, if you can't be faithful where you are, you won't be faithful where you ain't. Listen, there's nothing wrong with being ambitious and wanting to advance and go other places and experience new things and move up and all of that. Nothing in the world wrong with that. Go for it. We ought to be ambitious. Christians above all, we should want that. We should want to be the best in our company. That's good. That's all right. But we must learn to say, God, use me where I am today. Because I see this as my calling for this moment. Hey, that's when a boring, mundane, routine job can be transformed into a divine destiny. Who knows? Who knows that you have come to that place for such a time as this? Who knows? Do you realize what an astounding impact that kind of perspective can have not only on you, but on everyone around you for the glory of God? Wherever you are, whatever you're doing in this season of your life. So we try to conclude it with the final verses here. Mordecai says, Esther, maybe, just maybe, God put you where you are for a purpose, and that purpose is far more than your own comfort and happiness and safety. God may have brought you to this place so that you could use your position for His purpose. And His words clearly pierced her heart because there's a sudden change. Look at her response, verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Oh boy, something's happening now. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. What in the world has taken place? So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. It's amazing how a moment of crisis will bring us to our knees. Isn't it interesting how when crisis comes into our lives, the first thing we want to do is get rid of it? And I'm at the head of the line. I'm right there with you. I don't like crisis. I don't like pain. I don't like trouble and hurt. And yet, as we just finished going through 1 Peter for like 42 years or whatever that took, we saw God use suffering and pain and hurt and hardship to drive us to Him. Here we see it again. Esther's looking out for her own safety, as any of us tend to do. And yet this moment of crisis, what's the first thing it does after she regains her reason and finds her center in God? It brings her to her knees. She says, oh, Mordecai, we need to be in prayer. get everybody to pray, fast and pray. There's nothing magical about fasting. It's just saying, I'm going to set aside my most basic human necessity, food. I'm going to go without food, and I'm going to seek God above everything else. And now she's in the best position she could possibly be in, because God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. She's on her knees. But the one thing I find most beautiful about Esther's response is that she finally surrenders her life to the will of God. It's what we're seeing here. We're seeing surrender. Even though she doesn't know how it's going to turn out, that's surrender. Surrender isn't saying, okay, God, show me how it's going to turn out, and then I'll do it. That's not surrender. That's control. She says, I'll do it. I'll surrender myself to the providence of God, and if I die, I die. Wow. Esther has finally taken all three of the vital steps in following God: belief, surrender, and obedience. Belief, surrender, obedience. Many people believe and many people obey, but far too many of us skip that all-important middle step of surrender. We go straight from belief, oh, I believe God, to obedience. Okay, I'll obey him. And we skip over that middle, crucial middle step of surrender. And we never come to that place where we surrender all of our personal ambitions and plans and pride and fears and possessions and desires to the plans and desires and will of God. And what you end up with, if you go straight from belief to obedience, are a bunch of frustrated, annoyed, disgruntled Christians gritting their teeth and obeying God out of a stiff, wooden fashion, out of duty and obligation, rather than out of joy and excitement and passion. They say, fine, I'll obey God, because I guess that's what Christians have to do. And it's so sad. So they feel like everything God asks them to give up, from the small things to the large things, he's ripping from their hands, and they're angry and bitter about it their whole life. But show me a Christian who has come willingly to that second step of surrender, that person who has happily laid down their ambitions and plans and pride and possessions and desires to the plans and desires and will of God. And I'll show you a person who has discovered true joy and freedom and fulfillment and life. Surrender. Surrender. It's really only when we've come to that place of total surrender, where we're willing to say, like Esther, if I die, I die, that we're then actually really ready to start living. As long as we're holding on madly to our lives, trying to save them, we'll never actually be free to live life at all. The person who's already dead is free from the fears of everything that might kill him. Once we've died to ourselves, we're no longer afraid of anything that can kill us. And so we're free to actually live for God, regardless of the outcome. We're no longer hindered by our own fears or distracted by our own pursuits. That's a person God can use, because they're happy to go wherever God calls them to go. They're happy to lay down whatever he asks them to lay down. They're happy to do whatever he needs them to do, because they've already died to themselves. So if they die again, they're not really dying at all. Esther said, I'm not living for God in the shadows anymore. I'm willing to take a stand. I'm willing to risk everything for him, even though I have no idea how it's going to turn out. And if I die, I die. Have you ever come to that place of surrender? I pray that we could live our lives that way. Lives of full surrender for the one who surrendered his all for us. Let's pray.
You've been listening to a broadcast from Life Point Church in Greenville, South Carolina. If this ministry has touched your life in some way, we would love to hear from you. Just visit our website at www.lifepointsc.org for more information. Or, if you prefer to reach us by letter, you can write to us at P.O. Box 27036, Greenville, South Carolina, 29616, USA. Until next time, may God bless you as you continue to follow Him.